This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
A narrow isthmus, a mere thread, connects the Montauk Peninsula to the rest of Long Island, formed of piles of rubble left behind as the glaciers retreated eons ago. Here there are packets of forest, scarred and fluted cliffs. Prairie grass still shimmers on the last acres of downs, and beach sand is streaked with dark red garnet. This is G.P. Gottlieb, host for New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. And today I'm talking to Celine Keating about her new novel, The Stark Beauty of Lost Things. This is a novel about nature and landscape, the changing seasons, and how the idea of place changes definition depending on who is speaking. Someone who owns a piece of land, a home, a business, or someone whose ancestors neglected to purchase property, and what would become the village of Montauk in the ridiculously expensive Hamptons of New York's Long Island. And then there's Clancy Fredericks, an orphan who never knew a home and was shuffled from one place to another with physical scars to show what kind of childhood he endured. He remembers a few happy moments, though, and one of them is in Montauk, where he shows up for a party and ends up becoming immersed in the community.
Hi, Celine. Thanks for joining me today.
Thank you so much for having me, Galit. I really appreciate it.
The Stark Beauty of Lost Things. What were the lost things in your title?
I think the natural world, it's beginning to become encroached upon in the novel. Some sense of community, the fabric of the community is also being frayed a bit. And the feel of the world, because houses are popping up little by little. The world that the characters initially know is sort of evaporating. And I guess nature itself, I would say that's part of what's getting threatened through this story is the natural world.
So true. It was a beautiful novel. I enjoyed it immensely. I know of Montauk and the Hamptons only from television shows or hearsay, but it really does sound like a playground for the wealthy. Can you say more about what it's like to be in a place of great physical beauty that caters mostly to the rich?
I would say the Hamptons in general do fit that profile, although there are many people, ordinary, regular people who live there who are not wealthy. But Montauk was always the outlier. It was sort of the little stepchild of the Hamptons. It, until very recently, was very working class, people who considered themselves locals. Nobody was there in the winter except locals. And so it didn't really cater to the rich until the last few decades, began to change in the 80s. And so it's been a it was a very interesting thing to watch, because it was because as time went on, it's become sort of transformed into much more of a playground for the rich. Mm-hmm. But until, you know, at the same time, I would have to say the people who live there year round do get to enjoy the ocean and the beauty and the woods and all of that, though many of them have to work all summer to make the money to last through the winter. So they don't enjoy it always in the same way that the wealthy do, who pop in and pay, you know, $40 for a cocktail.
Whoa. Okay. Weather plays a big role in the story. I loved your descriptions. Can you delve into that for a bit?
I loved the seasons. I spent a lot of time in Montauk, obviously, and I loved watching the seasons, and the weather is such a big piece of the nature of the place. The winds will come from certain directions, or you know to walk on the beach in the morning before it gets too windy, or when people would go surfing depended on the weather. So it's really like an essence of the place. It's almost its own character. Mm-hmm. And that's in real life as well as in the novel.
Yeah. So Clancy Fredericks is a complex character. Can you introduce him and his motivation for driving 3 hours from Queens to attend a party in Montauk?
Well, when the novel begins, his girlfriend has broken up with him. He's kind of at loose ends. So at the edge of despair, and a good friend has encouraged him to come to this party, and he's kind of just desperate. So he goes, why not? And then while he's there, he has a sort of life-threatening event that is sort of transformative. And in the period right after that, he learns that someone from his past who was very important to him and who had brought him to Montauk as a child for a visit actually lives in the town. And so he reconnects with that person, and that sets the novel off on its course.
Mm-hmm. As I mentioned,
I realized I failed to mention that he was a foster child. He had lost his parents at an early age, so he has both emotional and physical scars from his background.
Mm-hmm. As I mentioned in the intro, the concept of home is also like an additional character, mm-hmm. where people live, why they leave, and why some people just give up the idea of it. Can you address that in your novel?
Yeah, I think one of the things I wanted to explore was the poignant fact that there are places where people grow up and love an area, and then they're not able to afford to stay. And that's been happening over time and is currently the situation in Montauk, that many, many local families, the children of those local families can't come back. They just can't afford to live there. And in fact, the workforce is, you know, often will be commuting literally 2 hours away mm-hmm. to work in the town. So home is a crucial aspect. Both in the story, the given characters are fighting really to save their homes. And then also, you know, I think in a broader sense, we're all trying to save this home that's the earth that is under threat.
There's a lot of sabotage going on of the earth, of the place, of the woods. Clancy learns about sabotage to the Army Corps project involving sandbags. Can you say more about that and the subject of sabotage?
Oh, that's very interesting. Well, with the sandbags, there really is a dune reclamation project that's just underway now from the Army Corps. There was a temporary one. And nobody did actually sabotage those sandbags, though there was a big demonstration at one point where people were trying to block the act of putting them in because they felt that that's not a natural way to solve the problem of beach erosion. But so in the novel, one of the characters takes it upon herself to do an act of sabotage. And it's sort of her way of fighting back against what she feels is sort of the rape of the land or mm-hmm. the ruination of the place. So I guess it is something of a theme.
Yeah. We meet Julianne, a painter, and she tells Clancy about land restrictions and access rights to the beach. What's going on with that? Is it like in Hawaii, where no matter how fancy the hotel is, they have to let regular people drive or walk through their property to access the beach?
Yes. On a lot of Long Island, and particularly out there in the east end of Long Island, it's public right of way up to sort of wherever the high tide line is or low tide line. But sometimes you can't get there. You might have to go a couple blocks away, get to the beach, and then you can walk all along the beach. There are some fights over access in a couple of places where property owners have managed to fight in the courts to preserve their little piece of beach. But generally speaking, the beach is considered public access. Though the story in there with Julian and her fence was based on something that really happened, that where I lived, there was a story related to that where somebody attempted to block the beach, and we eventually did fight and win in that in court. But it was one of those situations where somebody just says, I'm going to dare you to take me to court. I'm going to do it because I think I can just prevail, even though the law is not on my side. I'm going to make you go to court to uphold your rights.
And wow. And are you still going to Montauk? Or if not, why not? It sounds like you loved it.
Oh, it was the deepest place, you know, of connection for me. I would say it was sort of my soul place, and I didn't think I would ever leave. It did get to the point where my husband and I were getting older. My husband didn't want to keep going back and forth from where we lived. We had a little apartment in New York City, and we would go back and forth, and we couldn't afford to stay there. We were in a very tiny one studio apartment, basically, so it wasn't going to be livable, and we, you know, for permanent living, and we couldn't afford to buy a house or something larger. So it was very, very ironic, because I'd written the book, and then it was like I was a character from my book who was, you know, it was the same thing was happening to me, which is ironic. Though I've landed on a beautiful coastal part of Rhode Island that is actually probably closer to Montauk as the crow flies or as the seagull flies. And so I do go back very frequently. I have friends, and I'm actually still involved with the environmental organization that I've been a part of for decades. I can't quite sever that connection.
Is it the same one that Julian belongs to? Because she belongs to the environmental group called SOS. Right. And here's a quote. She says, there wasn't one big environmental disaster looming, like toxic sludge or tainted drinking water. It was death by a thousand cuts. Can you explain?
Yes. I did base it loosely on my environmental organization, though, you know, very loosely. And I think that's how I experienced it, as like little by little, one little thing after another. My organization has been excellent at trying to do what it can, but you know, there's only so much one can do, even as an organization. There needs to be zoning changes or townwide or regional changes to deal with the complexity of the environmental challenges currently. Mm-hmm. But we did, you know, the organization has done a fabulous job preserving land, you know, working against all sorts of environmental ills. And now at this point in time, the issues that are environmental there are really the bigger, larger issues, and there aren't that many small local issues. It really is the ones that everybody's trying to contend with, you know, the effects of climate change, etc.
Right. But what about affordable housing? That was something that everybody was dealing with.
Oh, yes, definitely. Now, my organization had nothing to do with that. It's strictly environmental.
Okay.
But affordable housing, workforce housing, dealing with the whole issue of making the area affordable and livable for people is one that they're still grappling with. And unfortunately, because it's very hard to fight against big money that will come in and really sweep up small places. And of course, if you're a small business and you're old and your children can't afford to live there and take over the business, then of course you're going to take the big money, and then your kids can have a great life. You know, it's a hard decision to make as a family to not accept those kinds of offers. Yeah. So one after another, you know, one small restaurant, one small motel, Now it's international conglomerates that own a lot of those places.
Yeah.
Big change.
So everywhere. So Julien specifically paints Montauk landscapes, the bays, inlets, dunes, grasses. Can you talk about her art and what inspired you to make her an artist? Is she based on someone?
She's based on a few different people I know who do landscape painting. I love landscape painting. I dabble in painting a little myself, but only on the most amateurish level. But I liked the using the analogy of her trying to capture the world of Montauk in the way that I guess I was trying to do with words. So, she's trying to hold on to the landscape that she loves and the world that she wants her son to grow up in. And that's her way, trying to, I guess, capture it before it might disappear.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is what it is. It's happening everywhere. So Teresa yes. Nolan is, that was whose father had been kind to Clancy years before, when Clancy was being shuffled from one foster house to another. She's filled with rage. And you don't explain why until later in the book, but we see the way she holds herself, the way she speaks to people, and the way she doesn't let anyone get too close. You write, her heart was a tightly closed clamshell. Only minute grains of sand or water could make their way in. Can you say more?
I found her the most interesting character to write. She really fascinated me in her sort of contradictory aspects, that she is full of rage for, grievance against her father. She's also very self-reliant and a tough woman. And I liked her vulnerability and her, I guess it was her spirituality. She's a real loner, a real solitary. And it was interesting working with her because I wasn't sure until the end what her trajectory would be, whether how far she would go in changing and being able to, let people in. And I don't know quite who she represents. Maybe the old types that would go, like the people who gravitated to Montauk years ago, were kind of outsider-y types. They were people who could live sort of all winter long with no restaurants around, no movie theaters, not many people. And so there were some tough or complex or troubled people who were drawn to Montauk in the early days. So she sort of represented one of them. And I think there were people I saw around town who I would be curious about, and sort of she grew out of some of those characters that I saw. Mm-hmm. I was intrigued by her.
Yeah. Another voice is Molly. She's as truculent as Teresa is. Molly is sweet and lovely and giving. Could you introduce her and Billy and Billy's brother?
Yeah, Molly. So Molly is somebody who comes out to Montauk after school, after college, like many young people do, that, for a fun summer. And she falls madly in love with the place and with Billy, who's a fisherman. She meets him at the end of the summer and she stays on. And it's very sort of jumping off a diving board. She's never done something so crazy before, but she's sure that he's the right person for her. And he's got a little brother. They have lost their parents and he's taking care of his little brother, who she becomes a mother to. And I do think of her as a little bit the Wendy of Peter Pan, that she's somebody very giving, somebody who just loves to take care of people and is always the sort of positive. And I liked her as a, not a foil, but as a contrast with Teresa. And Teresa takes her under her wing. And Molly just is enthralled by the world of fishing. What it's involved with and the elementary nature of it. But she doesn't actually get to become a fisher person. She just works in the fishing market. But anyhow, she loves where Billy lives, and Billy's house is one of those that's very desirable. The area where it is very desirable, and he's under a lot of pressure from a developer to sell, who wants to sort of buy up this whole stretch of land and put in, fancy condos or houses. And he thinks practically, like, we should take the money and it will give set us up in life. And she wants to hold on to his house and the past that it represents. So there's a little bit of conflict there. But it's a situation that many people there have faced.
Mm-hmm. Celine, I hope there's still a working bookstore in Montauk, and I hope they're hosting you. And when they do, and your neighbors and friends and everybody in the community comes to hear you speak about the stark beauty of lost things, are people going to recognize themselves? What's going to happen?
Well, that is a great question. And happily, I can answer it because I had one event already and one coming up, actually. But I was a little worried how people would receive this. And also, you know, you always worry, do they think I got things right? And I was very gratified that it's had a wonderful reception out there. There's not really a local bookstore. There's a local store that has a little book area. So they're carrying the book, and East Hampton is carrying it. And the library is hosting me in next month, actually. But I've been very happy that apparently I've sort of gotten it right, or they feel that I'm getting an angle on the town that hasn't been represented before. So that's a wonderful, wonderful feeling.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's a gorgeous book, and I wish you the best with it. I'm wondering what's next for you. What are you working on now?
Oh, thank you for that praise. That really means a lot. I'm working on a new book with a very, very different theme, but also has a sense of place. It's set on Rhode Island in an area that I discovered. It sounds bizarre, but is actually the place that had the greatest number of slave trading ships going back and forth to Africa. It was part of the triangle trade. So the book is actually somewhat focused on looking at that history, but it's told through the point of view of somebody who, an adopted young woman who's looking for her biological parents and finds out that she's part of this history. Although, of course, many generations before. So it's a very different type of story, but also has to do with home and community and sense of place. So I guess there are those tie-ins.
That's your thing. You're feeling it. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Galit. I really, really appreciate it and love your podcast.
And thank you for joining me. Again, this is G.P. Gottlieb, author of the Whipped and Sipped Mystery Series, and host for New Books in Literature, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. Today, I've been talking to Celine Keating about her new novel, The Stark Beauty of Lost Things. Hope you all have a beautiful novel to cuddle up with tonight and always. Thanks for joining.